What if Napoleon had never been defeated? Imagine he had conquered the entire world. Or suppose that Rome had done that, or Queen Victoria. Would we have world peace then afterwards? It's maybe tempting to think so, for the big difference between the anarchy of international politics and the relative stability of a nation state is that in the latter there is a monopoly of violence. Then our best chance to get rid of the lawlessness of the international arena may be that one nation conquers the whole world, no? If so, then should we not cheer for aggressive superpowers? Or is it not that simple? What does history say? There are, of course, no precedents of a truly united Earth, but there was once a conqueror who was never defeated, and so was able to capture almost any land that he fancied. This man was Alexander the Great. Had he not suddenly died at the tender age of 32, he almost certainly would have conquered a lot more still. There was probably no power on earth capable of challenging him. So on the surface, this looks like a unique chance to bring unknown stability. But what instead happened was a generations-long world war spanning three continents, a civil world war even. Greeks fought other Greeks, Macedonians fought other Macedonians, and though they didn't play the first fiddle, local peoples got cut up in the middle all the time, sacrifices on the altar of war. Like the kings of Europe at the time of World War I, all the main players in this ancient struggle knew each other intimately, and more often than not, they were related through blood or marriage. This fascinating period is known to history as the War of the Diadochi, Greek for successors, or also, more poetically, as the Funeral Games. That's because it broke out almost immediately after Alexander's death. He may have predicted it. It was even rumored that he explicitly willed it to happen. Indeed, that he made sure it did. He had refused to groom a successor. Instead, when he was pressured to say who his empire should go to in case he perished, he reputedly answered, "To the strongest." In other words, go fight it out. And as he lay dying, he supposedly would have added, "I think I see a great contest after I'm dead." Hence the funeral games. It sounds rather too cinematic to be true, but on second thoughts, you can think of multiple reasons why he might have said something like this. For starters, it would not be untypical of his character. As far as we can make out, Alexander was fond of competition and indeed bloodshed, and we can imagine him not looking forward to the prospect of someone else inheriting his wonderful army and using it to surpass his own accomplishments. After all, that's what he had done. It was his father Philip who had united Greece under Macedonian leadership, built the world's best army, and even established a beachhead on the Asian coast. This enabled Alexander to conquer the mighty Persian Empire, thereby outshining his dad. Which is why we now know Alexander as the Great, while some of you may never have heard of Philip II. When Alexander was still king in waiting, he is said to have complained out loud that his father was taking all the glory for himself, leaving nothing for him. So this was a guy that was clearly thinking about his legacy even before he had one. Stirring the empire towards implosion and the civil war would ensure that he remained the greatest, at least for the foreseeable future. It was not so hard to predict that this would happen. If there was no ready successor, you didn't need to go to the Oracle of Delphi for that. But it even makes some cynical sort of sense, even if we ignore Alexander's peculiar sense of destiny. For is this not how many present-day dictators reason as well? Soon as I'm gone, there will be chaos. Saddam Hussein did that, for instance. And now some well-known dictator is doing it too. Make sure that your underlings are considered worse and less reasonable than you, and make them hate and fear each other. It's the perfect insurance policy. While as soon as you name a successor, even if it's a villain, at least some of that guy's supporters get an interest in your demise. No wonder that many kings keep their wills as a closely guarded secret until the moment of their death. For the underlings, it's even dangerous bringing it up as it stirs the ruler's paranoia. This is nicely illustrated in Game of Thrones, when an advisor asks his queen, What happens if she gets shot by a stray arrow or something? You've been contemplating my death quite a bit, haven't you? Came the blood-curdling reply. This is a rational attitude, but also a selfish one, for it's no idle threat. When the inevitable happens, chaos ensues anyway. The moment that Alexander snuffed it, it was on. Everyone started looking at everybody else. Who is my enemy? Who can I work with? And for those few who didn't have grandiose ambitions, how do I stay alive? This always came down to another question. How can I get the soldiers to follow me? Money would help, but the Macedonians didn't fight exclusively out of selfish desires. Although we can't know for sure what the hoi polloi were thinking, the evidence suggests that most saw Alexander as close to a demigod, and Macedonian kingship was considered a hereditary anyway, so only Alexander's relatives were seen as fit to rule. And Alexander did produce offspring. The trouble was, he had taken his time with that. Before he went off to conquer the world, he had shown little interest in the opposite sex, to the desperation of his whole entourage, by the way. Until this day, this has fed rumors that he was gay, also because of his special relationship with one of his friends and sub-commanders. Now, eventually, he did marry, and multiple times even. These marriages were clearly meant to endear him to his new Asian subjects. He had, for instance, married a daughter of the Persian king, his old adversary, Darius III. He also had a Sogdian wife, Roxanne, who was pregnant at the time of his death. The second Alexander died, these women became each other's worst rivals. Roxanne acted quickest. Before Alexander's body was even cold, she sent a messenger to his Persian wife, Darius's daughter. She was still unaware of her husband's death, and the letter was, supposedly, written in Alexander's name, inviting her to come to Babylon, where he had died and where Roxanne was. So when she arrived, Roxanne had her killed. One off the hit list, many left to go. Now, she comes across as quite a cold-hearted creature, as will all the other females in this story. But to their credit, they had little choice. Roxanne was carrying Alexander's child. Once, or rather if it ever came of age, he was the logical next king. Supposing that it was a he and not a she. But that would block the path of all others who wanted to succeed Alexander. And they were unlikely to wait and see if he was a boy or not and let him grow up. So Roxanne and her unborn child were dangerous players, whether they wanted to be or not. And so they would be hunted by the most powerful people alive. She had to kill or be killed, and she was not alone in that situation. Someone who might have sympathized with her, had they not been rivals, was Alexander the Great's full sister, Cleopatra. She had the same supposedly divine blood in her veins as her brother had, so she represented a lot of legitimacy too. At the time, she ruled as regent in Epirus, since the death of her husband, who also happened to be her uncle. This incestuous marriage was concocted by Alexander's father Philip to keep Epirus in his orbit. But her husband was now dead, meaning she was available. All the aspiring successors to Alexander proposed to her. As with her more famous namesake, who ensnared Caesar and Mark Antony, I suppose it wouldn't matter if she were a stunning beauty or not at all. Every ambitious general wanted to become Alexander's brother-in-law, even post-mortem. The downside was that she had no choice but to participate in the deadly power game that was about to unfold. Like with Jumanji, if you don't play, you die. And she had to think carefully which aspiring lovers to turn down, for they were unlikely to take that well. For those who could not marry her, or wanted to get to the top job by another route, she was a threat. Yet another woman in a similar position was Alexander's mother, Olympias. It was through her that Alexander was supposedly related to the demigod Achilles, so she had the same sort of semi-divine blood in her veins. On top of that, she even supposedly had a special relationship with the god Dionysus, of whom she was a priestess. According to a story, her husband Philip was no longer willing to share her bed once he found her sleeping with a snake. Now, the gods were known to mate with mortals in the shape of animals. Just think of Zeus and Europa. Such stories, by the way, could have led Alexander to believe in his own divinity. Although it is equally possible that it was propaganda, it would suit Alexander that people would believe he was the son of a god, so this kind of story was just what the doctor ordered. A byproduct of that was that Olympias was also revered by many of the common soldiers, something that she was well aware of, and she was prepared and capable to use it to her benefit, which again made her dangerous and scary to many powerful men. But also, like the other relatives of Alexander, it made her untouchable in a way. You could not simply kill these people, or your own soldiers would kill you. Olympias's fate would be intertwined with that of Alexander's son. If he became king, Roxanne would become queen mother, and Olympias the queen grandmother. So she would team up with her daughter-in-law, whether or not the two liked each other or not. And then there were the other relatives of Alexander. Unlike him, his father Philip had rather liked the women. He had multiple of them, and we don't even know how many kids he fathered all in all. But it hardly mattered, for Alexander, or perhaps Olympias, had most of these children murdered the moment that Philip was dead. Better safe than sorry, they must have reckoned. There were a few who survived these purges, however, almost certainly because they were not seen as a real threat. The only mature man in that position was Alexander's half-brother Philip Aretaeus, son of Philip by another wife. It is no coincidence that he was known as a half-wit. No one could imagine him ever taking the throne, so he was considered harmless and spared. There were rumors that this was due to poisoning or some other malign intervention by Olympias, Alexander's mother, who would have wanted to eliminate him as a rival to her son. This is impossible to verify, of course, and it may well be part of the propaganda that was later unleashed against her. As we will see, some of her worst enemies would gain the upper hand at some point, and history is often written by the winners. That said, given how ruthless she often acted, she would probably not refrain from such an act, if ever she had the chance. I wonder, however, whether Aretaeus may not have been stupid like a fox, perhaps. After all, the sources remain pretty vague about what was wrong with him exactly. Alexander seems to have taken a liking to him and taken him on campaign, perhaps to shield him from assassins, or perhaps because he enjoyed his company. Now, Alexander doesn't strike me as the sort of man who would look after a simpleton half-brother in his free time. So how did Philip Aretaeus manage to get and stay on his good side? For good measure, we are talking about a tempestuous, impatient warlord who didn't think twice about killing relatives or old friends if it suited him. I'm not sure a real half-wit could avoid irritating him. A similar case comes to mind. The Emperor Claudius, who survived the purges of Tiberius and Caligula because they considered him a harmless idiot. Once he became emperor, though, he turned out to be nothing of the sort. Now, the example of Emperor Claudius also shows that Aretaeus could still become king. Claudius was crowned by the Praetorian Guards. And likewise, after Alexander's death, there were some in the army who wanted Aretaeus to succeed him, especially the rank and file. The commanders, however, preferred another settlement. They intended to wait for Alexander's son by Roxanne to come of age, which would take a while, and in the meantime, they could rule in his stead, which is of course the whole reason why they wanted this. Eventually, a compromise was struck. Alexander's son and half-brother would reign together, but under a regency. And this brings me to the other, even more important players in this story, the generals. I apologize in advance for having to introduce so many characters this time, but to be honest, the upcoming story is impossible to narrate without mentioning at least some of them by name. Rest assured, I'll keep things as simple as I can. And also rest assured, that's a lot more simple than they were. There were many more important players involved that I'll gloss over for the sake of simplicity. Now that said, in this case, memorizing a few names is worth the trouble, even or especially as almost all these super august figures will get whacked in quick succession. Like in Game of Thrones, the more important a character seems, the quicker he will lose his head. Which, if you're like me, keeps you on the edge of your seat. You never know what will happen next. It also helps you get a sense of just how murderous these funeral games actually were. And apart from that, introducing them is warranted because a few of the survivors at least found dynasties that will live on for centuries. Among them, of course, the Seleucids, that get to rule most of Alexander's Asian's possessions, including Iran. Spoiler alert, the man after whom they are named, Seleucus, could in many ways be declared the winner of these funeral games. And yet, when the major players first get together to try and work out a deal, he doesn't even have a place at the table. So a very unlikely winner indeed. The odds-on favorite was Perdiccas, his most trusted general, whom the dying Alexander had entrusted his signet ring to. Whether this meant anything more than take care of current affairs, that's open for debate. In my mind, it means much more than that. Perdiccas could put Alexander's seal of approval on official documents. He clearly commanded loyalty from a large part of the army and was supposedly even offered the kingship, which he refused. Wisely, no doubt, he understood that, for the moment, only those closely related to the late king could legitimately be called kings. But since he held both Alexander's half-brother, Roxanne, and her son, he became the empire's sole regent. If he took the crown right away, it would immediately invite the antagonism of all the other powerful players, and more importantly, it would give them the perfect rallying cry to convince his troops to abandon him. He usurped Alexander's kid, can you imagine? Perdiccas understood that this was as close to the ultimate prize as he could get for the moment, but he was already making plans to become part of the royal family himself, and the shortest way to do that was by marrying Cleopatra, Alexander's sister. If a son was born from such a union, and Alexander's own kid would unfortunately choke on some chicken bone, well, you can do the math. The trouble was, if you and I can see that this was the plan, don't doubt for a second that all his razor-sharp competitors could see it coming too. For the time being, Perdiccas held the best cards. The heirs, the loyalty of many troops, Alexander's signet ring, his corpse, most of the loot that Alexander had accumulated and stored away, and not unimportantly, a reputation for being a good general. That last item mattered more than you might think. In Macedonia, even kings could not expect unconditional loyalty. They were expected to win wars and divide the spoils. If they failed to deliver, they were cast aside, as Perdiccas would find out. In the meantime, his rivals would pick away at his other advantages, and they held some good cards of their own. Perhaps his most serious contender was Antipater, the old man that Alexander had left behind to look after the homeland during the years that he was away on campaign. Because there was always a possibility of an insurrection back in Greece, Antipater was allowed to keep a massive force at his disposal, and he received lots of money with which to buy loyalty in case of need. This was shown to be no idle precaution, by the way. The moment that news came out that Alexander had died, Greek cities rose in revolt, and Antipater was effectively besieged. He was saved by the intervention of other major players, because they reckoned that he was their best hope of stopping Perdiccas from gaining absolute power. If that happened, that would put them in grave danger too. He was likely to get rid of any prospective rivals when he could. It's worth talking a bit more about this Antipater guy, and to do that, we'll have to put a flashback within this flashback to the time just before Alexander's death. And why not? Family Guy does it all the time, so why can't we? So Antipater was in charge of Macedonia when Alexander was off conquering the world. He was not left alone, however. Alexander's mother Olympias also stayed behind, serving as the king's eyes and ears. It's clear that she and Antipater were constantly trying to slander each other in their letters to Alexander. Antipater had always shown himself loyal. In fact, it may have been his intervention that ensured that Alexander swiftly succeeded his father. But Olympias was his mother, and therefore the only person in the world whose interests were completely aligned with his. So who was he going to believe? It's not unreasonable to think that Antipater feared what the likely answer might be. He grew more nervous when he heard that Alexander was now executing longtime allies with frightening regularity, The king was clearly bloodthirsty and paranoid in his later years, if not before. And then, in the middle of these purges, he at once summoned Antipater to come to Babylon. The old man understandably suspected a trap, so instead of going himself, he sent his son Cassander. He was about the same age as Alexander, and the two of them knew each other intimately. They may have studied together under the famous Aristotle. Perhaps the idea was that Alexander would go easy on his old comrade, that he could perhaps be persuaded to trust Antipater again. And if not, then he could check whether the troubling rumors about the king's state of mind were founded and take measures accordingly. When Cassander finally got to see his old classmate again, he will not have liked what he saw. Persian dignitaries were trying to get on the king's good side by sucking up to him, falling on the floor before him and such. Alexander was going local, so it seemed. Cassander was unprepared for such a spectacle, and openly made fun of it. Knowing what we know now, this seems incredibly foolish, but he had known Alexander well, and it had always been customary for Macedonian barons to speak their minds against their king anyway. In their minds, that was what separated them from the slaves and tyrants of Persia. Would you find it easy to treat an old friend like a demigod? Cassander quickly learned that Alexander was no longer ready to put up with such informal behavior. According to the story, he was gravely mistreated by the mercurial king. So if we assume that Cassander had been sent to see how reasonable Alexander was, and this is what he found, well, what do you reckon would be his logical conclusion? And what would be his next step? To have him killed, obviously. But how to do that without losing your own head in the process? Well, it just so happened that the brother of Cassander, and so the son of Antipater, was Alexander's cupbearer. The man who had to taste his wine to make sure it wasn't poisoned. This is testament to how close the two families had until recently been. Alexander trusted this man with his life. Now, the fact that Alexander suddenly died of mysterious causes right after this incident with Cassander, right after demanding that Antipater lay down his command in Macedonia and come see him, well, it's far from proven, and most historians even seem to disagree, but to me, it looks like the circumstantial evidence is quite overwhelming. There's the perfect opportunity, multiple and serious motifs, even a need to act quickly. If, of course, all this was not later concocted by Cassander's enemies, which is what most historians seem to think. Their best argument, as far as I can tell, is that there was no known poison at the time that would cause Alexander's symptoms when he died. But how can we ever know every poison in stock at the time? Now, there are other plausible explanations why Alexander might have suddenly died. He had campaigned in different exotic climates for years, rife with diseases. He suffered bad wounds that might have infected. And in between these battles, instead of resting, he liked to party hard. In fact, Alexander was a hopeless alcoholic. So Henk Sinjoor, among many others, believes his death was just caused by a combination of illness, exhaustion, and a destructive lifestyle. Then again, if you want to be taken seriously as a historian, it's never a bad strategy to go for the most boring explanation. Perhaps being no fun is a professional bias of sorts too. Of course, as a podcaster, I have the opposite impulse, so call it wishful thinking if you like, but in this case, I find the best story the most persuasive also. But I'm not telling you what to think, of course. Let's just say it's still a cold case. What is not in question, however, is that if Cassander or Antipater did order a hit on Alexander, then it sure paid off for them. Antipater was not executed. Instead, he could stay on in Macedon and Greece, and he could further enlarge his power in the coming years. The man sent over to replace him arrived after Alexander's death, and then joined up with him instead. So if anyone profited from Alexander's death, it was Antipater and his son. Come to think of it, isn't there a scene in Game of Thrones when something goes wrong with the king's wine at just the right time for someone with access to his cupbearer? Anyway, Antipater was still a very strong player, one who had been absent at the original meeting where Perdiccas became regent, no less, and so he was a logical opponent for him. He Even more so, since Perdiccas refused to marry Antipater's daughter, he had another bride in his crosshairs, as we'll soon see. Antipater was also the archenemy of Olympias, Alexander's mom, who would not have forgiven him his earlier slander against her, let alone the fact that he may have been responsible for her son's death. Given the mutually exclusive ambitions of the commanders, the initial compromise was unlikely to hold. Another reason for that was the fact there were still close relatives of Alexander on the loose, who might confer legitimacy on whoever got them. This was like the fuse in a barrel of TNT, and it was lit by the daughter of Philip II, Alexander's half-sister Sinane. She tried to marry her own daughter Eurydice to Philip Arrhidaeus. A child that would be born of this union would gain a level of legitimacy that was greater than that of Perdiccas. Indeed, in the earliest stages, the infantry had wanted Alexander's half-brother to become king already. And what's worse, in the meantime, Sinane and Eurydice would conceivably control the kingdom through the latter's supposedly simple husband. Perdiccas could not let it happen. In the ensuing struggle, Sinane was killed, which made Perdiccas' own troops really mad at him. The anecdote demonstrates that you couldn't simply kill Alexander's close relatives. After this, Perdiccas' prestige was gravely diminished, and he had to allow the marriage to go through. When he, for his part, tried to marry Alexander's full sister, he overplayed his hand. He was clearly trying to become the next king, and the other big players then decided to conspire against him. So although seemingly still holding the best cards, his position was becoming precarious. His enemies were waiting for their opportunity to strike. The man who started the upcoming fight was yet another general that I haven't introduced yet, Ptolemy. Alexander's trusted bodyguard and founder of the later Ptolemaic dynasty. It had been clear from the start that he didn't intend to let Perdiccas have it all. Instead of letting him get the regency over King Arrhidaeus and over a Roxanne's boy, Alexander IV, he had proposed another arrangement, in which the main players would hold the regency together. He eventually accepted Perdiccas's regency, but he in turn could retain the rich satrapy of Egypt, which he already held under Alexander. This early rift between these men already foreshadowed what was to come. Ptolemy arguably held the most valuable piece of territory, yet he lacked the legitimacy that a half-brother or son of Alexander provided. But he was a resourceful man, and so he found other ways to get a bit of Alexander's aura. Ptolemy did something that seems unbelievably disrespectful and therefore risky. Alexander's mummified body was transported west to be buried according to his supposed wishes. But in Syria, Ptolemy intercepted the funeral march and forced it to his own domain. In the ancient Persian Empire, of which Egypt had been part, it was common for the new king of kings to bury his predecessor. But even apart from that, possession of Alexander's body might give Ptolemy some extra legitimacy. It was tricky, for we can imagine that common soldiers who revered Alexander might balk at this treatment. But we don't hear much about that, perhaps because Ptolemy argued that Alexander should be with his real father, with which he meant the Egyptian god Amon, adopted as an incarnation of Zeus by the Greeks. Now, at least someone was mad as hell about all this, namely Perdiccas. He gathered his troops for a frontal attack on Egypt, but he was faced with some serious setbacks, which cost him much of his men's remaining loyalty. He was murdered by some of his own commanders eventually, among whom Seleucus, who thereby makes his first noteworthy political move. So only in the second year after Alexander's death, his most probable successor already snuffs it. The regency then fell to Antipater. So the two kings, Alexander IV and Philip Arrhidaeus, were both transferred to Macedonia. And Antipater also made sure that an important ally of his was given command of Asia. This was Antigonus One Eye, a veteran general, thus named for obvious reasons. In return for his favor, Antigonus agreed to marry Antipater's daughter. So the latter appeared in control at that point, but he was an old man and wouldn't last long. As he lay dying, for whatever reason, he decided that Alexander's signet ring should not go to his own son Cassander. Instead, he gave it to Polyperchon, an older general who didn't look like much of a threat, even as the nominal regent. Fascinatingly, his son Cassander didn't seem to agree with the plan, and he openly opposed Polyperchon. And in fairness, his father had probably underestimated that man. In a move that cannot have been to Antipater's liking, he recalled Olympias, who had fled from her old enemy Antipater to her homeland, Epirus. The new regent was clearly seeking to gather even more legitimacy through the support of Alexander's mother. But then again, as Antipater probably foresaw, this attracted unwelcome attention from the other ambitious generals. Cassander managed to unite all the main players against Polyperchon, including Ptolemy and Antigonus Cyclops. And last but not least, Eurydice, the wife of one of the kings that Polyperchon was supposed to protect. In return for coming over to him, Cassander left her in charge of Macedon. She convinced her husband Philoparidaeus to name Cassander as the new regent. At this point, Alexander's mother enters the fray. She feared that her enemy Cassander would get the upper hand, which would pose a grave danger to her grandson Alexander IV and to her. So she gathered an army in Epirus and invaded Macedonia with it. Eurydice had her own army there, ready to do battle. So now you have this quite unusual situation of two women leading their own armies against each other in the field. And it gets weirder than that even. When push came to shove, Eurydice's soldiers simply refused to fight Alexander's mom. As we said, you can't just attack one of these semi-divine figures, and Olympias was closer to Alexander and his divine dad than Eurydice, who was merely a granddaughter of Philip's. Eurydice was captured and then fell into Olympias' hands, together with her husband Philoparidaeus. Alexander's mother then showed the same viciousness as Alexander himself had during his purges. The half-wit king and his queen were swiftly done away with. So if she was not responsible for Aridaeus' unknown condition, Olympias I mean, then she was in any case responsible for his death. And as we can imagine, this may have shocked the soldiers too. Perhaps this explains why she could not repeat her magic trick on Cassander's stronger army that soon swept in. Cassander captured her and had her quietly murdered, no doubt hoping that the rank and file would not find out. So this Cassander, Alexander's old friend, may at this point have been responsible for wiping out most of Alexander's family, perhaps even including the man himself. Quite a payback for his own mistreatment by the late conqueror. The only one he left alive, for the time being, was Alexander's young son. But he was now in his custody, so it was a safe bet he wasn't going to live to ripe old age. Polyperchon, for his part, fled to Antigonus One Eye. Antigonus had all this time remained in Asia. At the first meeting of Perdiccas's killers, he was given the task of rooting out the dead regent's allies. First among them was the only big player of non-Macedonian descent in his whole story, a Greek called Eumenes. At first, this had seemed like little more than a formality, but Eumenes proved incredibly resourceful and skillful. He even managed to capture the royal treasury at Susa in Persia, which automatically gave him a lot of bargaining power. His biggest problem was his lack of legitimacy. Not only did he have no royals in his custody, he was not even Macedonian and therefore despised by many of his men. To make up for this, he declared that Alexander himself spoke to him in dreams. And he went to great lengths to pretend like the ghost of Alexander was still actively helping him. You have to admire his creativity and daring. Then again, if you have a bad hand, you either have to bluff or fold, and Eumenes was not afraid to play hardball, clearly. He lost mostly because the Cyclops managed to get his hands on his baggage train, with its riches. In exchange for their goodies, Eumenes' men were prepared to give him up, and the Cyclops then had him killed. Clearly, the whole tactic of speaking for the ghost of Alexander turned out to be less than effective, but it was worth a try. But what about Seleucus? As a reward for betraying Perdiccas, he was offered the rich satrapy of Babylonia, but probably for the same reason that Polyperchon was made regent. He was considered too unimportant to be a threat. But through cunning and sheer luck, he would outlive all the other main players and end up with the largest piece of territory. Indeed, the Seleucid Empire would at its height be the biggest in the world. At this point in our story, though, he didn't hold many good cards. No noteworthy legitimacy, no great treasure or army. When Antigonus, who had just done away with Eumenes, subsequently came to Babylon, Seleucus had no choice but to welcome him. But as soon as the Cyclops himself set his eye on his satrapy, Seleucus simply had to flee. So he seemed finished before he really got started. How did he dig himself out of that hole? For starters, what sets Seleucus apart is that he seems to have had more consideration for a group of people that has been absent in our story, but who may well have been the most important, the original inhabitants of the empire that the Dyadochi were fighting over. The Greeks and Macedonians usually considered them barbarians, but there were signs that Seleucus had a different attitude early on. Flashback. While Alexander was still alive and kicking, he had tried to co-opt the Persian elite and absorb it into the Macedonian one. With that purpose in mind, he had obliged his commanders to marry Persian women, daughters of satraps and other elite figures. No one had any choice in the matter, and it must have been traumatizing. Unlike their kings, common Macedonians were not supposed to have multiple wives. And it flew in the face of cultural sensitivities too. A union between a Greek and a so-called barbarian had hitherto been invalid, and so their offspring was not recognized. That changed now, which must have been a relief for soldiers who could now recognize their children. But after Alexander's death, all but one of the high-level marriages was annulled. And the exception was that of Seleucus. It has been suggested that this had to do with genuine love for his wife, but it was probably the smart thing to do, for it sent a message to the locals. And this would prove especially fruitful for Seleucus, for he would in time find himself in possession of the heartland of the old Persian Empire. He managed to win the favor of the Babylonian elite. His approach, apparently, contrasted sharply with that of Antigonus, who replaced him there in Babylon. The Cyclops reportedly began a reign of terror. At the very least, he was a lot more demanding and less respectful than Seleucus had been. Moreover, Seleucus proved adept at manipulating the other main players. He apparently told them that Antigonus was going for it all. He had no trouble convincing Ptolemy, who welcomed him in Egypt. But more surprisingly, also Cassander, who had been Antigonus's main ally. In case you hadn't noticed, there's a pattern here. Everyone attacks whoever sticks his head too high above the grass. And like others before him, Antigonus now proved unable to cope with the united opposition. A new arrangement was made, in which most of the Dyadochi could hold on to what they already had, except for Seleucus, strangely. Having fled earlier, perhaps he had little to offer, and Ptolemy was not inclined to support his claim on Babylon out of sheer gratitude. It didn't work that way. For Ptolemy, the new alliance with Antigonus and Cassander was more important. He was even willing to turn a blind eye when Cassander killed Alexander's son, who became dangerously close to reaching maturity. Some were already clamoring for an end to the regency, so that Alexander IV could become king in his own right. Antigonus and Ptolemy would probably have been relieved that this kid was out of the way, but they could still have stoked outrage against Cassander. They didn't seem to have done that, which would have made clear to Seleucus that their alliance was solid for now. But Seleucus was not done for yet. He still had a considerable force and commanded a reasonable amount of loyalty. He would stay out of the fray for now and concentrate on the eastern provinces. As he may have foreseen, the love affair between the Dyadochi would not last long. And again, it was love that would tear them apart again. Ptolemy and Antigonus both fell for the same woman, Alexander's full sister Cleopatra, the one who had earlier been courted by Perdiccas. People with royal blood were becoming ever more rare, and therefore more precious, and she remained by far the biggest prize around. Whoever got her hand would thereby gain massive legitimacy, an advantage that the others could never hope to surpass. She eventually lost her heart to Ptolemy, but their love story was bound to end in tragedy too. She was intercepted on the way to Egypt, no doubt on the instigation of the jealous Antigonus, who had also had his eye on her, pardon the pun, and she was then killed. "If I can't have her, no one will," the Cyclops must have cried out. So, a crime of passion, clearly. The extinction of Alexander's bloodline now cleared the way for the remaining Dyadochi to declare themselves kings, starting with Antigonus. Note that there were no rules for kingship, except that it would fall to the royal family, something that had now become impossible. What remained was raw power. The kingship was not linked to a certain territory or anything. All these kings would retain the universalist ambitions of Alexander, even if they were practically unable to act on them. And any king had to prove himself in battle, or else he was seen as weak. It was all a leftover from the kingship that had existed in Macedonia when it was still a minor statelet in the north of Greece. This also meant that the person of the king was the only thing that kept these realms together. These characteristics ensured that the Seleucid realm would prove very unstable once it was in place, but we aren't quite there yet. As always, Seleucus had been quick to take advantage of the rupture between the other generals. Antigonus's priority was to deal with Ptolemy, and so he agreed to leave Seleucus alone for now. The latter used his truce to further focus on the eastern parts of Alexander's empire. That was less threatening and less important in the minds of the other Dyadochi, but it had a lot to offer in terms of riches, and there were no comparable opponents there, except for one. Before he was forced to turn back by his weary soldiers, Alexander had defeated a few Indian leaders. It was the snakes, crocodiles, and monsoons that had forced him to turn back. His troops simply had had enough. It had much less to do with the opposition. After all, up till that point, there had never existed a big empire in India. So it can hardly have been a coincidence that very soon after, there emerged one for the first time. It was probably the lingering Macedonian threat that convinced the Indians to unite behind their first emperor, Chandragupta Maurya, someone we will talk about more in the series on India. This new Indian force would prove a more than worthy opponent for Seleucus. So they went at it for a while, but soon enough, the two leaders, who were both pragmatic men, came to understand that they had more to gain by coming to terms. They made a pact that would prove key to both their fortunes. Seleucus agreed to give up the Indian territories that Alexander had conquered, in return for about 500 Indian war elephants. At first sight, this looks like a humiliation for him, but in reality, he probably had no hope to keep control of these lands anyway. The pact enabled the Mauryas to consolidate their startup empire, as it gave Seleucus a free hand to fight his rivals in the west, who was certain to come for him eventually. And the elephants? What difference would they make in a war of that magnitude? Well, you'd be surprised. The Macedonian armies were unlike anything that the world had ever seen, but their strength lay in two main areas, their heavy cavalry and their disciplined phalanxes. Elephants proved exceptionally effective against both. Horses wouldn't come near an elephant, they panicked as soon as they caught their smell. Only patient introduction to the sight and smell of these beasts could change that, something that the Seleucids could in time do. And as for the infantry, the Macedonian phalanx worked only as long as everyone stayed in close formation. The men carried extremely long spears and needed the help of the men behind them to wield them properly. If operated correctly, the phalanx became a pincushion of super long spears that was near impossible to penetrate. But what better technique to disturb such an organization than a large group of stampeding elephants? Like horses, I imagine that humans wouldn't be at ease confronting these monsters either, even apart from their actual power, which was enormous. Once their organization evaporated, what remained was a group of terrified individuals, with very little protection and wielding weapons that became nearly useless through their size and inflexibility. Exposed in this way, they were poorly equipped to fight a regular swordsman, let alone an army of elephants. True, the Persians had elephants when they were defeated by Alexander, but only a handful of them. Too few to make a difference. They could be isolated, surrounded, and taken down. 500 of these animals, that was quite another matter. Meanwhile, it was the turn of the overconfident Antigonus to overplay his hand. Cassander felt he couldn't stand up to him any longer, so he asked for peace. But by demanding that Cassander handed his whole territory over to him, Antigonus in fact forced him to fight on desperately. Worse, this demand alarmed the other Dyadochi. If they let the Cyclops swallow Cassander's territory whole, they would be the dessert. Antigonus had not become wiser with age, it seems. Now a very old man, he found himself encircled by a giant coalition. He was defeated and killed, but that wasn't the end of his line. His son escaped and later took advantage of Cassander's death and the ensuing civil war in Macedonia to take control over that region, which would eventually become the core of the Antigonid Empire. It didn't matter that this was a different region from the one Antigonus originally occupied. As I said, kingship had nothing to do with territory. But he then in turn overplayed his hand. He tried his luck recapturing Asia, only to be defeated and killed by the armies of Seleucus. Back in Egypt, Ptolemy also died, which left Seleucus as the last man standing. He held by far the biggest territory, more or less equal to the old Persian Empire that Alexander had conquered. He had won. But there was still no prospect of peace. And that had much to do with the nature of these kingdoms. Despite the fact that the successor kings took Alexander's claims of divine heritage to the logical endpoint by claiming to be gods themselves, in essence, they still remained glorified warlords. They presented their lands as won by the spear, the same way that Alexander had claimed the whole of Asia by right of conquest, by throwing his spear in the ground as soon as he set foot on Asian soil. This also highlights that there was no link between the dynasties and the territories that they occupied. They remained invaders and strangers in their lands. There was no common identity between the people, the elite, and the ruler. The only thing that united the Macedonians in Asia was their desire to tax the general population. Their loyalty to the king depended largely on his ability to ensure that. As warlords, the kings had to wage lucrative wars, reward their men, treat them with a certain respect, and even lead them in battle personally, which meant they were always at the risk of dying. And that was especially dangerous given how crucial the king was for the stability of the kingdom. A similar negotiated settlement existed with the local elites. The Oxford Companion to the Hellenistic World summarizes the fragile workings of the Seleucid state as follows, quote, "The empire was thus like a network of bilateral relationships between the ruling king and the communities in their sphere of power. The links probably had to be renewed or at least confirmed at the accession of a new ruler. The empire was, as it were, recreated with each successive king." End quote. Not a recipe for stability, needless to say. Now, this reaffirmation of local loyalties was less of a problem if there was one uncontested and able successor. Seleucus understood this. In a way, he did the opposite of what Alexander had done. He installed a very capable son of his as co-ruler, and the prince would have 10 years to learn the trade before he ascended the throne. What if Alexander had acted that way? Would there maybe have been peace then? Well, still not likely, as the fate of the Seleucids shows, at least not in the long run. The fact that so much depended on there being one capable head of state, that would always provide opportunities for enemies to exploit sooner or later. Rival powers profited from brotherly rivalry and do their best to stoke it. Seleucus, by the way, died while trying something of the sort with the Ptolemies, who had the same structural weakness. He was reportedly murdered by a Ptolemaic rebel prince that he had given refuge. When dynastic crisis inevitably occurred, rebellions would follow. The main reason why the Macedonians usually managed to suppress these, eventually, was probably that these revolts were isolated affairs. That was the upside, from the ruler's standpoint, of there being no identity that bound the empire's constituent parts together. Local rebels were so distinct from each other that they were unable to coordinate their resistance. But that didn't mean that these returning rumblings didn't put pressure on the state. And apart from these internal conflicts, there were always external ones as well. The fact that the rulers needed lucrative and prestigious victories simply to avoid having their place contested by their own people, combined with the fact that, like with Alexander, their ambitions literally knew no boundaries, that pretty much ensured constant war. The Seleucids and the Ptolemies immediately fell out, and over the coming centuries, they would fight five or even six so-called Syrian wars, which is a bit of a misnomer even, since these were not just about Syria. As I said, their ambitions knew no bounds. They wanted it all, and sometimes they came close to getting it. At one point, the Ptolemies ventured deep into Mesopotamia, while the Seleucids later captured Egypt. They were both unable to consolidate these gains, however. Despite their constant conflicts, the Antigonids, Ptolemies, and the Seleucids all intermarried. Another similarity with World War I, and in this case too, it didn't soften tensions even one bit. Quite the contrary, it gave the other side a means of disruption and a reason for intervention, as far as they felt they needed one. The greatest setback in the wars against Ptolemaic Egypt came after the Seleucid king agreed to set aside his wife, and the mother of his heir, for a Ptolemaic princess. "Let's unite our houses, then everything will be fine," that was the theory. Alas, it proved more of a Trojan horse, because it caused division within the royal family. The original heir did not accept his demotion, and when he proclaimed himself king, this gave the Ptolemies a reason to invade a now divided country, which almost proved fatal for the Seleucids. Governors took advantage of the situation to proclaim their independence, including Pasha, which was thereupon taken over by the Parni. These Pashans would end up occupying most of the Seleucid domains, partly because the Seleucids were more occupied with the Ptolemies and the Romans. The latter would also foster discord inside Seleucid ranks, for instance by taking a younger prince hostage and then supporting him in his claim to take the throne from his brother. At some point, it still seemed as if the Seleucid fortunes would shift, as they managed to capture Egypt from the Ptolemies, but the Romans interfered and forced them to withdraw. This was a milestone. From then on, the Romans were clearly the biggest player in town. They didn't suffer from the same institutional and ideological weaknesses. The enormous reparations that were due to the Romans would force the Seleucids to become more demanding of their tax-paying population, which caused more unrest. They were now permanently on the back foot and had little hope left of driving out the Parthians, especially since they didn't give their eastern domains ample attention anyway, until it was too late. But then again, ignoring the Romans and the Ptolemies was not a realistic option either. So was there really anything that the Seleucids could have done differently? Well, they might perhaps have done more to forge ties with the locals. As we've seen earlier, the Parni so thoroughly adopted the culture of Parthia and mingled among its local elite that they soon became indistinguishable. They are even known as Parthians today. The Sasanians took a different approach. They rolled out a bureaucratic and ideological system with the Zoroastrian faith as its main pillar. The Seleucids, by contrast, never really lost the Greek attitude of treating the Asians as barbarians, although they became less open about that. But the Greeks were snobby about their own culture, and they made very few concessions to local custom. In that regard also, their approach could hardly be more different from the later Parthians. Greek culture was still so much regarded as the pinnacle of civilization that the Parthians, even while fighting the Seleucids still, and even as Greek cities kept revolting, they kept promoting themselves as Philhellenes, in other words, as lovers of Greeks. And they openly adopted aspects of Greek culture. You may remember that when Crassus was killed, his head was used in a Greek play called the Bacchae that was being performed at the moment at the royal wedding. You can say that this is testament to just how fantastic Greek culture was, or it may highlight that the Parthians were just so much more open-minded and flexible in their attitude than the Greeks themselves. They also presented themselves as the descendants of the old Persian Empire, for instance, something that the Seleucids would never do. Maybe the Seleucids forgot what their founder had understood better, at least better than his opponents, and what may have enabled him to found his kingdom in the first place. He built strategic alliances with locals. True, Seleucus never tried to connect himself to the old Persian dynasty either, but he did show respect, and this brought him support, if only because it contrasted with the approach of his enemies, and most notably Antigonus One-Eye and his son. The army with which he won his greatest victories depended heavily on Asian horsemen and Indian elephants. Later, Seleucids were not more respectful than, say, the Ptolemies, who in time absorbed many local customs. Now, this was understandable. The whole concept of their empire was wealth extraction for the benefit of a parasitic foreign elite. To avoid being overrun, a constant stream of immigrants from Greece and Macedonia was even needed. Partly to attract such fellow Greeks, the Seleucids founded colonial cities for their compatriots in strategic locations. You can imagine their marketing: leave your squalid village in nowhere land and come live as the ruling class in exotic Persia, with all the pleasures of home. Indeed, at surface level, these cities seem almost like an exportation of the Greek polis. The fact that the polis was exported on the back of Macedonian expansion would be kind of funny, since it was Philip II, the great uniter of Greece, who destroyed the traditional autonomy of the original Greek polis like Athens. Still, the appeal of the new polis must have been impressive. Greece itself suffered from a sort of exodus, it seems, further impoverishing it and making the East look more appealing by comparison. Of course, the immigrants would be expected to fight for their privileged position, and hence for the empire that guaranteed it. Now, city building can in itself be a centralizing force. The Sasanians consciously ran an urbanization program and encouraged people to live in them so that they could more easily be controlled, and also, no doubt, to limit the power of the nomads. The Parthians had nomadic origins themselves, and they paid more attention to co-opting tribal chiefs, and city building so was not really their priority. But by contrast, the Seleucids were great builders, but their cities were meant to shield their elite from the population at large in a way. It's interesting to compare this to how other conquerors have acted through the ages. Take the Mongols. In places where they isolated themselves from the settled population and remained on the steppe, they usually kept their privileged position for longer. This was in a way a reflex comparable to that of the Macedonians. If you're the dominant minority, then sticking together is a means of survival. So too with the Arabs. After their great expansion, they founded huge garrison cities, reminding the soldiers of home and giving them power through unity. These cities, in time, attracted local fortune seekers anyway, whether by design or not. For instance, Babylon became depopulated under the Seleucids simply because inhabitants migrated to a newly founded city nearby. That place probably received more attention, while Babylon succumbed to neglect. Once there in these new cities, some of the newcomers adopted Greek habits, like working out at the gymnasium, because they sought social promotion. That was never encouraged, though. If it happened, it would be superficial and limited. Therefore, the name Hellenistic period is somewhat misleading even. It makes it sound as if there was a mixing of cultures going on all the time. Now that said, there is a cultural legacy worthy of note here. For one thing, the conquests of Alexander and the Seleucids brought the Greek world in contact with Eastern civilizations. This influence is still seen, for instance, in the common look of statues of the Buddha. Originally, Buddha was never depicted in human form, but as a wheel. The Mauryas of India were Buddhist, and they maintained relations with the Seleucids and other Greeks. It may even be no coincidence that there are so many similarities between Buddhism and the Greek Stoicism that became so popular around this time. In both these systems of thought, A central theme is that life is suffering, and that you can only escape it by detaching yourself from worldly desires and expectations. But then again, in both East and West, the suffering that decades of civil war wrought would in itself create a market for that kind of thinking. Speaking of which, remember our opening question? Would we have world peace if one nation conquered the world? By this point, asking the question almost equals answering it. But maybe the conditions after Alexander were just exceptionally bad? Well, even then, at the very least, today's story can reveal a few obstacles that would have to be overcome. First, lasting stability is impossible as long as everything depends on the health and whims of one person. That would definitely rule out peace under Nazi world domination. But perhaps not in a theoretical worldwide Pax Romana. The Roman Republic had certain mechanisms in place to smoothen the transition to new leadership. But secondly, you also cannot have lasting peace as long as you have a distinction between conquerors and subject peoples. In theory, you could give everyone a Roman or American citizenship, but in reality, that seems unlikely, and even if you did that, it would likely invite unrest in the heartland, wouldn't it? Those with most to lose are the ones that run things. And finally, you would have to eliminate the inbuilt mechanisms that enabled expansion in the first place, like the need for ever more military prestige or riches. That would prove a hard nut to crack, and not just for an openly aggressive empire like Rome, but even in capitalist societies like Victorian Britain. So my conclusion would be that even in the best possible conditions, involuntary unification is highly unlikely to lead to lasting peace. Let's not try it anyway. Thank you for listening. Talk to you next time. Bye.